Worried about your future in tech? Master new skills, accelerate your team's impact, and redefine what's possible with Pluralsight. We're more than just another online learning platform. We're shattering the skills gap and shaping future generations of technologists. Transform your work. Transform your team. Ready to tap in? Visit us at Pluralsight.com to learn more.
With the state of today's economy, it's more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made from the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back in your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality, made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Due to the themes of this podcast, listener discretion is advised. Lock your doors, close the blinds, change your passwords. This is Secrets and Spies. Secrets and Spies is a podcast that dives into the world of espionage, terrorism, geopolitics, and intrigue. This podcast is produced and hosted by Chris Carr.
On today's podcast, I'm joined by Florian Flader, who is a journalist from the German broadcaster WDR. We discuss three German intelligence operations to acquire and study Russian military technology during the Cold War. I hope you find this episode interesting. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. Take care.
The opinions expressed by guests on Secrets and Spies do not necessarily represent those of the producers and sponsors of this podcast.
Florian, welcome back to the podcast. It's great to have you on. And I think for the benefit of maybe some new listeners, if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yes, I am an investigative journalist working for the German public broadcaster WDR in Berlin. And I am part of a joint investigative unit consisting of actually two public broadcasters, WDR and NDR and Süddeutsche Zeitung. And we have done some investigations in recent years. Some people might be familiar with Panama Papers, Paradise Papers, and also the Pegasus spyware, and lots of international investigations that we did with media from around the world. And I am mainly focusing on national security and defense topics, and I'm mainly working on intelligence-related stuff right now.
Fantastic. Well, we're going to be chatting a little bit about some of the sort of contemporary history of the BND that started sort of in the Cold War, some interesting sort of operations that you're going to share with us today that you've found out about. But it just strikes me as it might be a good idea to give us a very, very quick dummy's guide to German intelligence for those who don't know what the BND is.
Yeah, we have several intelligence agencies. The big and probably most prominent one internationally is the BND, our Foreign Intelligence Service, which is also the military intelligence service that we have. There is an intelligence part within the German military and the armed forces as well, but BND is the military intelligence service, gathering information from around the world. The BND right now has about 6,500 people working there. So it's a big security authority in Germany. Stations around the world, they are connected to the embassies and consulates, the German embassies around the world, called residences. And the BND was founded just after Second World War. And it was established with American help. United States helped establish it, and they had a very good relationship with the first head of the BND, which was Reinhard Gehlen. Reinhard Gehlen used to be an intelligence officer in the Wehrmacht, and he was, some people would say he was Hitler's man for gathering intelligence on the Soviets and on the East. He was the head of Fremde Heere Ost, which was an intelligence component of the Wehrmacht back then. And after the World War, Reinhard Gehlen reached out to the Americans, and the Americans liked that he had a lot of knowledge about the Soviets. So they established him. And in the beginnings, it was not called BND, Bundesnachrichtendienst. It was called the Gehlen Organization. So it was named after him. And then the late 1950s, it became BND. And it was a secret intelligence agency during the Cold War. And quite interestingly, the BND just got his proper law, like a BND law, telling this agency what to do and what is allowed, just in 1990. So just after the Cold War. Before then, it was all basically do whatever you want because you're in your secret intelligence service. Mm-hmm. And the BND is not, the Foreign Intelligence Service in our country is not part of the foreign ministry or the defense ministry. It is connected to the chancellery. So it is, the oversight is within the chancellery, within the German government. And it reports directly to the chancellor, and but also giving briefings to the other parts of the German government, the other ministries. There is a meeting that is taking place every week, every Tuesday morning. It's called in German Nachrichtendienstliche Lage, and it's the it's basically the main intelligence briefing. And the heads of BND, of our domestic intelligence agency, the BFV, and the military defense agency, basically it's a counterintelligence agency, these three heads meet with the head of the chancellery, and they give a briefing every Tuesday on intelligence security related topics. And we will have a new head of the BND just this week.
Fantastic.
Tomorrow on Thursday, there will be a handover from the current head of the BND, Mr. Bruno Karl, to the new one, Martin Jäger. Martin Jäger is a very experienced diplomat. Up until now, he was the ambassador in Ukraine, German ambassador to Ukraine. Before that, he was the ambassador to Iraq and Afghanistan. So he has a lot of experience. And quite interestingly, because we're going to talk about this, the new head of the BND, he was in the early 1990s. He was a young student, and he is a professional photographer. And he traveled to Pakistan, and he traveled with the rebels, Mujahideen, whatever you want to call them. He traveled in the early 1990s from Pakistan to Afghanistan to take pictures in that very interesting conflict zone just after the Soviets left. So he has quite some experience in war zones, and he's going to be the new head of the BND.
Fantastic. You mentioned his experience. What is the sort of general feeling about the new head of the BND? Is it a sort of positive appointment, or are there any critics? Or
quite frankly, there are lots of positive comments about it, and I heard, and other colleagues also heard this and wrote about it, that Mr. Martin Jäger, he was really keen on getting the job. He really wanted the job. He basically applied for the job. And people in the government really like him. He's a very experienced diplomat. He knows how to deal with very dangerous situations and countries. And there's a new understanding of what the BND should do in the future. Also with regards to international cooperation, but also, stepping up to the challenge that is now ahead, which is basically the Russian aggression in Europe. And our former chancellor, Olaf Scholz, he called it Zeitenwende. So there's a new era now in Europe and a new focus with regards to security. And we talk a lot about what this means for the military, conscription, getting the military up for the challenge. But what does it mean for the intelligence services is a big question now. And this is going to be one of the main things that Martin Jäger will deal with. It's the relationship between the BND and German military, the armed forces. What is going to be this relationship in the future? What will the BND be part of when it comes to national defense and also NATO? Is there a new role for the BND? Can there be a new role for this service? So yeah, lots of stuff going on.
Thank you for that. So Florian, before we get into details of these sort of Cold War and sort of, should we say, late Cold War operations, what drew you into researching this sort of hidden side of German intelligence history?
To be honest, I was always a fan of intelligence history and spy stories from the Cold War. And in Germany, we as journalists, but just in general, there is a pretty journalist-friendly archive application or request situation. So you are able to get your hand on quite a few archive material documents from the archives of intelligence services. There are certain rules, so these documents have to be at least 30 years old. And then, of course, the BND will check if there's anything sensible still in there, anything that should be kept out of the public space. And then they will delete this stuff. You will not get your hand on this. But just in general, you can request a lot of archive material from BND. It takes some time. You have to be quite patient. So if you an application like that requests in the archives I would say in general take at least a few months, a half a year or a year before you get some documents. But I do this from time to time when I read something in a book about intelligence services, about spy stories, and I see something, just a topic or a person that I find very interesting, I do these archival requests. And then sometimes this turns up. And I get in touch with former members of our intelligence services, and some of the people that have retired in the old days, they will tell you quite interesting stories. Some of them still have some documents at home. even though I know that security services don't like that when people take these material back home, but back in the days in the Cold War, there was lots of paper. It was not it was not computer digital stuff. It was all paperwork. So this is also sometimes a source for the stories that I do, and that's why I'm interested in this.
Fantastic. Can you give us a sense of how the BND was positioned during the Cold War compared to the CIA, MI6, and other allied services?
So the BND, because of the situation that Germany was, West Germany and East Germany, it was basically the front line of the Cold War. There are lots of spy activity in Germany was going on back then. BND was regarded as one of the sources of information about the Warsaw Pact armies. One of the main tasks for BND was to keep track of what is going on in the East. What is the military situation in the East? What are they doing? What are these exercises, trainings? Is it just an exercise or are they planning an attack? So all this was the task of the BND, and they were mainly focused on East Germany and the Soviet Union. And of course, BND also was present in several places around the world where there was also the Cold War going on. So where these two blocs were fighting, parts of Africa, for example. There was also in the beginnings in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, there was quite some BND activity in South America as well. Reason for that was there was a huge German origin community living in South America. Also former members of the Wehrmacht SS, Nazis who fled to South America. Some of them were still in contact with their former colleagues, and some of their former colleagues joined the BND.
Yeah.
So these people were regarded as sources, as people that you could speak to. Some of these people in South America, they worked for the governments there. They were advisors for the military and intelligence services in countries like Argentina and other places. So the BND had quite a good network of sources and contacts in South America as well. And yeah, of course, BND was also providing information to NATO regarding East Germany and East German military. And sometimes there was discussion going on about the BND emphasizing or, you know, trying to get into the Five Eyes community and to be part of the broader Five Eyes community, but it never happened. And there were some joint operations taking place with the Americans, the Brits, and others. And yeah, BND was regarded as one of the services with lots of expertise on the East, on Soviet Union and Eastern Germany.
And so we're going to look at three operations. So the first operation is about the BND and the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. So what exactly was the BND's role in Afghanistan during the 80s, and how did it differ from or even overlap with the CIA's Operation Cyclone?
So the BND got involved in the Afghanistan conflict, so meaning the time when the Soviets occupied Afghanistan, and there was this kind of a civil war, which basically a war against the Soviets, Soviet occupants. The BND started to get involved in the mid-1980s. So in July 1985, a German delegation, members of the BND, the vice president of the BND, and members of the German parliament, they flew to Pakistan. And quite interesting, they used the airplane. The BND has its own airplane. It's kind of a business jet. It's the only authority, the only security service in Germany that has its own airplane. So these people flew to Afghanistan, to Pakistan back then, and they had talks in Pakistan with Pakistani intelligence, Pakistani government, of course. They went to Peshawar, to Islamabad, and to Karachi. And just after this trip that they did, and they were talking about how can we help Pakistan or the people in Afghanistan, how can we help with humanitarian help, what can we do basically also to fight communism in this region. And when they returned to Germany, they decided that the BND should start an operation. The BND should be involved in supporting the Afghan rebels back then, so the Mujahideen. Quite interesting, this was something that was really pushed forward by the members of parliament. It was not something that was really genuine coming out of the intelligence service itself, but as far as I can see from the files that I got, it was the idea of these members of parliament. These were members of our intelligence committee. And apparently, these people wanted the BND to get involved. So the BND in 1985 started this operation. Its operation was called Sommerregen. And what the BND did was they were sending lots of material. Basically, it was clothing, it was winter boots, it was flashlights, some kind of equipment, knives, tents that you need, some equipment, some electronic equipment to find landmines, medicine, night vision material, night vision goggles, but also motorbikes, communication systems, lots of this stuff.
So sort of support stuff, but not weapons by the sounds of it.
It was support stuff. So this is different from what the CIA did. But I have to tell you, there is a second part to this operation. And this is something that you cannot see in these files that have been declassified. This is something that people told me who were involved in the whole operation. And they said there was indeed part of Operation Submarine involving arms and weapons. Not a huge amount, but they would somehow get assault rifles, some older material, some material that was bought in other countries to the Mujahideen. And the BND got involved. They got in touch with the rebel leaders back then. Some people that are still present, still around, still alive, like Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. He is one of these guys who's still alive and still rooming. And he used to be the head of this rebel group, Hizb Islami. He was one of the biggest groups. And yeah, the BND was the one organizing the whole thing together with German armed forces. So the German military would fly this material to Pakistan. Then the BND would hand it over to the Pakistani intelligence service, and the Pakistanis would give it to the Mujahideen, but tell them this is coming from the Germans. So this is material that Germany is providing to you. And then the BND also opened a secret office very close to the Afghan border in Peshawar. And so they decided to open this, kind of a facility with just a few people working there, but intelligence officers working there. And this, when they started it in mid or end of 86 or 87, it was still present for a very, very long time, till 2010 or 11.
Okay. So I'm assuming that office then obviously played into the American invasion and other things too. Yeah.
Yes. So they still had this hub, like an intelligence hub there close to the Afghanistan border. Some people that were involved in Operation Summer Rain also told me that indeed German intelligence went into Afghanistan. So they joined the Mujahideen, they went to Afghanistan. And one of the main tasks for this operation was not supporting the Mujahideen. This was one part of it. This was done because the Germans needed the contacts, this relationship to the Afghans. But what the BND really wanted was to get hold of these Soviet weapons. They wanted to get their hand on these Soviet military material that was used in Afghanistan, for the purpose of analyzing it. And this was a huge part of Operation Summer Rain, was to tell the Mujahideen, if you get your hands on a certain helicopter, a certain missile, whatever, get in touch with us and get it to us.
Yeah, because there were similar operations that British military intelligence were involved with documenting Russian military equipment being used in Germany. Is it Bricksmith, I think is what it's called, where these sort of cars go behind the borders and sort of try and photograph tanks in action and things like that. And obviously Afghanistan being an active war zone, you've got all the high-tech equipment out there. They've got the Hind-D helicopters, tanks, small arms, etc. So it's, quite a lot of things that they for study.
I was told by someone working for BND who is he's not alive anymore. He told me back then that he received a phone call from the Americans telling him that a Russian Hind helicopter crashed into a mountain in Pakistan, very close in Afghanistan. Sorry, very close to the Pakistan border, and the Americans told the Germans get the helicopter.
Wow.
They asked him, get the helicopter, and they said the Mujahideen were able to capture one of the pilots alive. And the Germans were quite shocked for this request. They were like, what shall we do with the pilot? The Americans apparently wanted the Germans to get the whole thing, like to get the helicopter out of this mountain to bring it over to Pakistan to analyze this helicopter. And so it went both ways. So material went into Pakistan and then into the Mujahideen, but the other way around, the Germans would pick up the Soviet arms and military equipment and bring it to Germany and analyzing it and also giving it to the Americans. So this was also part of Operation Summer Rain.
Did he ever say what happened to the pilot? Do we know?
He told me back then that he told the Americans, that's not possible. We cannot do it. We cannot arrange a helicopter to be transported to Pakistan. And he told me that he asked the Afghans, so the Mujahideen, if they can tell him what's going on, where are the pilots, and they refused to tell him.
Wow.
So in the end, it was just an helicopter that crashed into the mountain. Nobody knows what happened. But these stories, these things happened, these incidents happened. And also Operation Summer Rain went on for the whole 5 years till the Soviets withdrew from Afghanistan.
Do you know much about how the BND established its presence in Pakistan? Obviously, having a forward operating base like that comes with certain risks.
I guess from the files that I read, from the declassified documents, you can see that the BND was very, very keen on having a good relationship with the Pakistanis. And in the declassified documents, there are also these, you can see all these bills after these travels. You can see what they bought and the beer and the whiskey and whatever they brought to Pakistan as gifts. So there was a lot of this going on. And in the end, I guess the Germans were very much liked by the Pakistanis and also by the Afghans. And so I don't think the BND had huge problems getting in contact with these people and having a good relationship. Till 2011 or 12, then something happened with the Pakistanis. They were not really happy about what the BND had done, and the Pakistanis actually exposed this secret facility of the Germans in Peshawar. And then BND personnel had to leave Pakistan and abandon this secret office they established.
Wow. And how did the BND kind of evade the Soviet forces out there as well? Because they were at risk from them.
I saw some pictures of BND people side by side with the Mujahideen. And you can see, of course, they are all dressed as civilians and they grew their beards. And similar to what happened after 9/11 and the first CIA teams that went into Afghanistan. So basically, from the outer appearance, these people looked like locals, or pretty much like locals. I think it was the number of Germans, German spies, or military officers going into Afghanistan in secret. The number was not really high. You know, it was just from time to time they would go in. There's one question that I found very, very interesting is. On the Soviet side in Afghanistan, the occupation forces, there is some information that there was also people from East Germany involved. So GDR, soldiers present.
Interesting.
Interesting to see that East Germans and West Germans maybe would meet on this battlefield in Afghanistan.
Yeah. Presumably they would have been working for the Russians. Is that right?
Yes. They are part of the Soviet occupation force. And there are some stories about East German soldiers that were present in Afghanistan. And but basically it was a good relationship with the Pakistanis and also by the Mujahideen. So in these declassified files, I also found some letters that were written by the Mujahideen leaders back to the BND, thanking them for their support, thanking them for what they have done. And interesting to think about, maybe these contacts that were established back in these days in the Cold War, maybe they could be of use today, and they were definitely of use after 9/11.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah.
Do the BND sort of, the BND veterans you interviewed, did they regard this sort of operation as a success, or did they have any regrets over it, especially in light of 9/11 and so on? I know certain CIA officers feel that their Operation Cyclone may well have led to the 9/11 attacks.
Interesting question. I have not heard someone say we have trained or armed these people that then attacked the United States on 9/11. So, and there was some, I mean, I don't know what your knowledge is about this, but I was told by several people from American intelligence and German intelligence as well, and Pakistani intelligence, telling me it's just not true that American arms and training, that Al-Qaeda and Bin Laden himself benefited from this. It's just not, I mean, it was mainly other groups. It was mainly local Afghan Mujahideen groups. It was not these foreigners. The Saudis did. They supported them, and but it was not that the CIA trained Bin Laden. I don't think that's true.
No, I've not heard of that. I think via the atmosphere of the time, if that's the right word, you know, certainly he probably picked up some things from that period. But I think a lot of the people the CIA armed ended up becoming the Northern Alliance, who were against the Taliban. I know that those networks became very useful in the early days of the hunt for Bin Laden and so on. But I've never seen anything convincing that says that the CIA trained Bin Laden. I haven't seen any evidence of that.
I heard people tell me, who were involved in this operation, telling me it was quite shocking to them to see how the Afghans were abandoned after the Soviets left in the early 1990s, and the country went into this chaotic situation, and the Taliban ended up being the government. Out of this civil war situation, and that the Western countries, they were not really interested in this anymore. There were these Quran schools in Pakistan where the people were radicalized, and this was still going on, and there was still Pakistani influence in Afghanistan. They would still arm and push lots of arms into Afghanistan to support a certain group, religious groups. I heard from people were involved from the German side saying, it was quite shocking to see how the West abandoned Afghanistan.
Yeah, indeed. And I think it's that environment that fostered 9/11, the Soviet. I think once the Americans have achieved their military objectives, they weren't interested any longer, which is unfortunate, really. But there we go. Is there anything else you'd like to add about the BND and the Mujahideen and that operation?
I was surprised to see that the BND was very much interested in what is happening in Afghanistan, even prior to the Soviet occupation, the Soviet invasion in 1979. And after it happened, the BND had quite some good sources in Kabul. And I saw documents, files, also maps that these sources drew for the BND. And they said, you know, in this building in Kabul, in this building, there's the KGB now stationed. So BND had a pretty good picture of what was going on in occupied Afghanistan, and even though they did not foresee the invasion itself, they did not foresee the attack. There's also some documents saying, we really missed that for several reasons, but after it happened, we had a really, really good picture of what is going on.
Yeah, fantastic. One fun question you may or may not have the answer to. So I read via a CIA memoir that the Saudi royal family like Ballantine's whiskey. Were there any whiskey brands that stood out to you that the Mujahideen or Pakistani intelligence figures may have favored?
I have to look into these files, but I think it was there was Johnny Walker mentioned somewhere.
It's a classic.
That was Johnny Walker.
Hopefully Black Label at least.
I have to look it up in the files, but there are and also they brought, what was it, some watches, some European, even I think even Swiss made watches, and I can get back to you if you're interested in this.
Yeah, well, the watches one. I know. Have you ever come across Watches of Espionage on Instagram?
Of course, yeah. I wrote about watches, and I also wrote about spies and gifts.
Ah, fantastic.
Because this is quite interesting. As a German government official, you're not allowed to, you know, to take or even... Take gifts or presents that have a very high value. So everything over 20 or 25 euros, you have to hand in the agency or the ministry where you're working in. But on the other hand, the BND is giving out a lot of gifts when they travel around. And there are some things that are quite unique and quite striking. For example, I heard people say that in Arab countries, with these Arab intelligence services, a very, very popular gift is a German knife.
Okay.
And it's a knife made in the town of Solingen. And the knife is made out of the steel of the Tirpitz, which was the biggest warship that was sunk in the Second World War.
Oh, wow.
And from time to time, divers went down and took the steel of that ship. And they made these knives out of the Tirpitz steel. And somehow Arab intelligence agency officials like that gift. And they also like footballs that are signed by the German national team.
That makes sense. Yeah, I know football's massive in the Middle East, so that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. And I think also gold-plated Hecker & Koch machine guns are also quite popular in the Middle East as well.
Yeah, from time to time, you have to be creative because you need something from your partner in the other country, and then gifts make it easier.
Yes, indeed. Fantastic. Let's take a break and be right back with more.
Extra value meals are back. For just $5, get a savory and sweet sausage, egg, and cheese McGriddles, plus hash browns and a coffee. Only at McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.
Well, we'll move on to Operation 2. So this was about buying Soviet weapons from soldiers in East Germany. So after the Berlin Wall fell, Soviet troops were stationed in East Germany. How did the BND sort of exploit that unique situation?
So, yeah, there were, back then in the early 1990s, there were still around 300,000 troops, Soviet troops. Present in the eastern part of Germany in the GDR. This was this short period after reunification, after the wall came down, then the reunification of Germany, and then the Soviets left in the late 1990s. But they were present in the 1990s still in the eastern parts of Germany, and these soldiers were really frustrated. They were, I don't know, they saw that their own country, the Soviet Union, was going down, and it was not really a pleasant time for them. Even though some of them liked being present in Germany, they liked the life in Germany. So what the BND did was they started an operation with the main goal of acquiring weapons, military secrets, documents, and also recruiting sources within these Soviet or Russian, then Russian military in East Germany. So they, together with the Americans, by the way, it was a joint operation with the DIA. And what they did was they established a headquarter for this operation in the southwest of Berlin in a villa of a former Wehrmacht general. There was this mansion, this huge house, and they used it as a headquarters for this operation. The Americans called the operation Matchball, and the Germans called the operation Giraffe.
Okay. Of the long neck looking in kind of thing.
Yeah, the long neck looking over these kind of still existing wall to the east.
Yeah.
So what they did was they went around contacting Soviet soldiers and offering money for weapons, offering crazy stuff like microwaves or, cheap cars. Do you need a car? I can get it for you. And just hand me over your tank. And in some cases, that really happened. And they would also go around, traveling around these Soviet military bases and looking through the trash that was there, because some of these Soviet troops, they would just get rid of whatever they had. And it was basically some kind of secret shopping tour that they did. And they also recruited sources. They recruited Soviet soldiers as sources. Some of them, they were running these sources for many, many years. Some of these soldiers, they then went back, of course, to Russia. And some of them made a career in the military. and they became high quality sources of BND and also the Americans. So this was this Operation Giraffe, kind of a quite a successful thing, because in the end, they ended up with lots of stuff that they wouldn't get their hands on in a normal situation. It was just, corrupt soldiers selling them secrets. There were some Soviet soldiers that deserted back in this day. And they immediately after the Berlin Wall, the wall came down and the GDR ceased to exist, they went to the West German military order, BND and others, and told them, I want to desert. I want to live in the West, and I don't want to go back to Russia. And also the BND had dozens, probably even hundreds of these soldiers were interviewed by the BND and by German military. And I read these interviews, and quite interesting what they told them. They were telling them about the feeling, the situation in these military bases, how frustrated they were, where people would go and, get super drunk. And so some people even were telling about prostitutes that were going around. And because these Soviet soldiers were just sitting there, they didn't know what to do. In Moscow, it was a chaotic time as well. So they felt kind of lost and, easy targets for intelligence services.
Well, yeah. And do you think the BND managed to kind of get a sense of like sort of Soviet tactics that might even still be used by Russia today because of all the files and things they got access to?
Yes, they got access to electronic equipment. They got access to encryption communication things. They got parts of tanks, parts of fighter jets, the MiG-29 fighter jets, the computer system of a MiG-29, targeting systems. They even got their hands on these electronic sniffing devices for nuclear and chemical weapons that the Soviets just had introduced into the armed forces. And had connected to helicopters. This is something that they got their hands on, and lots of stuff, lots of documents, secret documents that were used by the Soviets, and recruiting sources was another part of the operation. And as far as I can see from the files that I saw and people that were involved, some of these sources were, valuable, very valuable sources in the Russian military.
And do you think any are still active today?
I really don't know. I know that one of them was, extradited, was rescued, a rescue mission out of Russia, because in the late 1990s, the Russians, found some information leading to him. They then suspected him of being a spy. He was arrested once, but they released him because they couldn't prove that he was working for the BND. And he had met his BND handler back then. I think it was in Estonia back then, so he would travel back and forth. And on one of these trips to the Baltics, he was then brought to West Germany.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Fantastic.
Because there was something, and quite interesting to see the Americans were involved in this operation, the DIA. And I saw that they were pretty happy about how it's going on, how it was running. The Americans also paid for the whole thing. It was American money. It was American money and BND running around and, talking to these Russians or Soviet soldiers. And, the Brits later got involved, but there's quite an interesting second story to it. The British, I think she was the representative of the British intelligence services back in Germany. She contacted two BND people involved in this Operation Giraffe and asked them if they would sell some of the stuff that they got their hands on.
Oh, wow.
And
wow.
They met her in a hotel somewhere, I think in Munich. They met her, and later these two BND guys, they were put on trial for trying to sell stuff on their own and making some money on it. Yeah.
So this wasn't official, so to speak. It was kind of under the table.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Okay. Interesting. And it's interesting as well, like MI6 having to, go to that length and not necessarily, I guess the Americans weren't sharing this information with them, or they were after something specific. It's very interesting there.
Yeah. I was told by one person involved saying the Brits were involved in the end. So at a certain point, they were part of this operation, or at least they benefited from it. But once you keep all this stuff super, super secret, some people think this is a nice way to make some money and keep it out of the books. But apparently they were approached by this lady who was working for British intelligence back then.
Yeah.
She was identified in this court trial. She was identified as the representative of British intelligence in Germany.
And what happened to the BND officers? Did they go to jail for that, or did they get let off? Or?
I think in the end they were not sentenced. They were just, I have to look it up again, but I don't think they ended up in prison or something. No. Yeah, they met her in a Munich hotel. They met this British lady, and then they were accused of selling it for 67,000 D-mark back then, Soviet military secrets to the British MI6. Mm. Mm. That was the accusation. But I don't think it happened. I don't think they handed over material to her. And yeah, it was a crazy time back then. There's even a book written by a former BND guy about this operation. And he describes the whole chaotic thing in the 1990s and what they would do to get their hands on some stuff. And there was a lot of people selling material. Some of them was genuine, some of them was fake material. There was a huge market, black market for intelligence stuff.
Yeah, and it was a weird time for Western intelligence services, as quite a few were then sort of thinking, now the Soviet threat's over, there were conversations about, do we need spies anymore, which were a little bit naive, but certainly quite a few people did lose their job over that period of time, even though there's a lot of information floating around, yeah.
But you just mentioned some of that could be of use today when it comes to Russia, some of the techniques, some of the that they got a hand on. And it was a huge collection mission. And back then, I guess some people within BND and the German military, they would say, do we really need that? So, because this is a new time, Cold War is over, do we still need that material? Do we still need sources in the Russian military? But yeah, you need them. That's what you
do. Yeah. Peace and war. Yeah, totally. Well, is there anything else I'd to add about that operation? I mean, were there any veterans you spoke to, and how did they sort of reflect on their time doing that?
Yes, some of the people that were involved, they still wonder what the value of the operation is.
Interesting. Yeah.
They still ask themselves, saying, was it really worth it? Like running around for years, handing over money to these people and... but it was worth it. I mean, from what I saw in some files with regards to these sources, it's quite remarkable that they were recruiting these people and they would then end up having a career in the Russian military. So yeah, maybe they were not of use back then or after 9/11 or whatever, but they would be of use years later. Yeah.
Indeed. Let's take a break and be right back with more. Well, I'll move us to the third operation. So it's all about shipping East German weapons to Israel. So once reunification have happened in Germany, suddenly they inherited the GDR sort of arsenal, and the German military wasn't very interested in it, but the Israelis were very keen. Do we know why that was?
Reason for that was several Arab countries, several Arab militaries, Egypt, Syria, they still used Soviet weapons back then. So their whole arsenal was basically Soviet-made material. So what the Israelis wanted to know was what was the latest, like very modern Soviet military equipment and material. And you could find that in the GDR. GDR, they had very, very modern weapon systems. And so the Israelis wanted to get their hand on, because they thought this would be very much of use when it comes to their neighboring countries and their potential enemies. And so they wanted to analyze these weapons. They wanted to see what was the newest stuff that came out of these Soviet arms factories. And especially interested in missiles targeting, but also tanks. And so this whole thing was kept secret. This German-Israeli cooperation, exchange and joint analysis of material was kept secret for many, many years, until in October 1991, in the Hamburg harbor, just a regular police person just checking some material that was about to be loaded onto a vessel. They just checked them. It was basically a customs check. And on the papers, the material was declared as agricultural equipment, tractors, farm equipment. But when they looked into what was in these boxes and containers, it didn't really look much like farm equipment. It was weapons. And this was about to be loaded onto a vessel and then sent to Israel. And this was not the first time that a transport like this happened. It happened 8 or 9 times before that. But there was just one mistake that was made in 1991. The BND had not informed every authority, every police agency that could get involved in it. So it was, basically a cover-up mistake. Even though German military was knew about it, because they had to transport these weapons to a certain place, and they were the German military was the owner of these GDR weapons, and the German government also knew about it. So at least the chancellery, they green-lighted it. This was all known, but just one police guy saw that. He called the prosecutor's office. And he said, this is probably an illegal arms shipment to Israel. And it was not known in public, and it was not known in the parliament. So this was quite, it was steered up back then by the media, of course. Members of parliament, they asked to be briefed on it, and we need more information, and why is this happening? Why are we sending these weapons to Israel? And it's all part of a relationship, a cooperation between West Germany and Israel that started already back in the 1960s.
What was that? So can you talk to us a little bit about that sort of relationship? What did you find out about that?
Yeah, in the 1960s, because of the Six-Day War that happened, the German intelligence service was very keen on getting their hands on Soviet weapons back then. So it was the other way around. So in these wars, the wars of Israel and the Arab neighboring countries, Six-Day War, Yom Kippur War in the 1970s, these wars resulted in lots of Arab-Soviet material ending up in the hands of Israel. And back then, Germany, NATO, they were interested in seeing, show me what the Soviet Union, what the Warsaw Pact created. So what kind of new weapons were used on the battlefield. And so back then, Israel provided these weapons to Germany. And they would send it over to Germany. So there were Soviet tanks, Soviet-made tanks, captured from Arab armies in Germany.
Wow.
So they brought them to Germany. They were driving around German military bases. They were analyzed. And yeah, what the Israelis gave to the Germans even led to some developments and new creation in the arms industry. So the creation of the Leopard tank, of our Leopard fighting tank. Some of that, how the tank is built, some of the features it has, is the result of what the Israelis captured of these Soviet weapons.
Just shows you why these missions are quite important, really, because you want to be able to make equipment that can kind of compete with your potential foe. So yeah, it's very interesting.
And after reunification, all of this stuff from the GDR ended up with the German, West German military, or the then reunified German military. And there were lots of weapons. There were hundreds of thousands of AK-47s. And of course, there were tanks, and there were even fighter jets and other stuff. And in Germany, we didn't really have a use for it. But there were other countries, and I saw in some of the files from back in the day that some of the material was given to other countries as just a military support. They were just giving them to countries, telling them, use it, you can have it, you can use it. But then there was Israel, and the Israeli military attaché in Germany. He reached out to the German government saying, is there any chance that we can get this material, that we can properly analyze it and give you the results of our analysis of what we have done with these weapons? Because we have other means of testing these weapons, and maybe it's easier for us to do it than for you in Germany to do it plain sight. So the Israelis, they got several shipments of weapons from Germany, and it was not an illegal arms shipment. It was not a huge scandal, to be honest. It was just not known. It was a secret.
And that's what made it a scandal, kind of thing. Yeah, fantastic. Was there anything else to add to that? I feel like we've covered a lot of that. That's good.
I think it's important to understand it was just the other way around. From 1960s and 70s, it was the Israelis providing Soviet weapons to Germany and to other countries and NATO members. And then suddenly in the 1990s, it all turned around.
It kind of turned around. Well, just sort of look at the bigger picture now and today. I mean, looking across these operations, what do they reveal about the BND's capabilities and willingness to act outside its usual constraint?
I think these Cold War or just, 1990s operations show that there was a huge interest. There was a willingness to take risks. Back then, that was somehow lost in the way, I think. So if you talk to people in BND, they would tell you, we are not really risk-taking anymore. We don't want to take too much risks now. And it's maybe that's also a problem. We should act more like in that feeling, in that spirit. Mm. On the other hand, it shows that there was a lot of operations going on with the main focus of gathering military material. So the whole thing that we in Germany call fremde Wehrtechnik, or like foreign weaponry, as you call it, is a huge part of the job of the BND. It was a huge job in the Cold War, and actually it is a huge job now. To know what Russia, China, Iran, and others are building, what kind of whatever submarines, missiles, tanks they are building is still very, very important for BND, and it's something that they don't really talk about. So it's they like to talk about counterterrorism. They like to talk about how they are hunting down, I don't know, cyber criminals or Chinese hackers, and how they are analyzing the situation in Africa and migration and, I don't know, drug networks. But what is not really talked about is this military focus thing and getting your hand on military secrets of other countries.
Yeah. And obviously Ukraine is the place where all this is going on today, isn't it?
It is. And I think to a scale that we cannot imagine. because there's lots of innovation going on in that war, especially when it comes to drones and stuff. There's new updates on these new material every week, basically. So these weapons are getting changed and modernized, and there's just so much material thrown into this war. This is basically the place. If you want to get your hand on modern systems, this is probably the place we go to. And I asked people in BND, I said, do you think that Russia is withholding some weapons, some material? Because they know once it's once the Ukrainians get their hands on it, it will end up with NATO as well.
Yeah.
And surprisingly, I was told they don't have information regarding this. They have information that the Russians are using very, very modern systems. They are not withholding stuff. Of course, they are using also these old materials from their from back in the Soviet days that they still have. You know, they have tons and tons and tons of Soviet material, but they are not withholding new material. They are using. They are even testing new stuff like these Kinzhal missiles and other stuff that they have used. And BND is involved in capturing these this material as well, getting the hands on this material. The Ukrainians, I was told, are really, really good at documenting all this. Every single drone, every single missile that goes down, they are taking pictures of it. They are taking it apart, looking at all the material that was used to build these drones, all these computer chips and whatever. So they are really, really good at documenting this. And to a huge benefit to NATO.
Yeah. No, definitely. And I can imagine also then spies of the opposition are probably doing similar things to NATO weapons being used out there as well.
Yeah, this and it can be regarded as one of the main reasons why the German government was hesitating to give new material to the Ukrainians. Or certain kind of material. They were, when it comes to this Taurus cruise missile thing, and also tanks, they always have in mind this will end up with the Russians, and they will have a close look at it. And so we probably won't give away the stuff that we really need in case of war.
Makes sense. Yeah, definitely. Let's take a break and be right back with more. From your conversations with sources from the file and, from the files you've obtained, is there anything that kind of really surprised you a lot from this research?
Yes. When it comes to Operation Summer Rain in Afghanistan in the 1980s, I was surprised to read that in one document from the, 1989 or something. So the operation was already running for 5 years or 4 years. Someone in the BND wrote in this report, there is not much intelligence value to this operation. Quite an interesting statement.
Yeah, that's probably a career move, that as well.
Yeah, so it just says on that file, is a very low intelligence value, something like that. And I was wondering, why is that? Is that because all the weapons that the Mujahideen captured and gave to the Germans were already known, with material, old stuff? I don't know, but that surprised me. I was also surprised to see how deep this cooperation with the Israelis was. And it started already in the 1960s. And there was cooperation on many levels, and there was also support by the German side during these wars, Six-Day War and the Yom Kippur War. It was mainly signals intelligence, help and support with signal intelligence to the Israelis. It's not really surprising, but if you see it in a written form, it's kind of very, sometimes you see in the 1960s and 70s, there were still some people in the BND with a Nazi background. So they used to be part of the of the Wehrmacht or other parts. And you can see it in the way they write their reports, how they describe people, how they talk about the Israelis and the Soviets. And it's kind of it's a very harsh language.
Yeah.
And from back in the day. So at one point I read that the BND guy wrote down the Israelis, they underestimated the Arabs, similar to what we did with the Soviets, as we regarded them as Untermenschen back in the Second World War. So the kind of very strange things that they are comparing. And something that I found surprising is also how much the members of parliament were involved back then. It's something that is, very odd if you read it today. So that a member of parliament or a group member of parliament, the intelligence committee members, that they would tell the BND, you should start an operation, do this and do that. Something very odd. Something nowadays wouldn't really happen that way. So especially after Snowden, the NSA scandal and other stuff, members of parliament are very keen on showing that there are critics of the intelligence services, that they are, not really friendly with them in a way, but, they don't really trust what they are doing. So they have to have a very, very strict oversight. But back in the days, apparently they just bought in a plane, they flew to Pakistan, they had whiskey and beer and said, let's start an anti-communist operation. Let's do it.
Simpler times.
Simpler times and also political backing. So you could see that the parliament was telling these spies, do it. We are backing this up. We will give you the money. We will somehow get you the money for this operation. Just do it.
Yeah. What lessons do you think the intelligence services today, whether it be German, American, or others, still carry from these operations?
I believe that we talked about it, this risk-taking something. From time to time, you have to take risks. And if you look at Operation Giraffe, this thing that happened in the 1990s, there was Soviet counterintelligence going on in Germany. There was still KGB. I read in one file, it says there is a rumor of KGB and GRU assassination units running around, trying to assassinate people before they could desert or, change sides. So it was a dangerous time back then. And also some of these BND people involved, they were exposed when they were sneaking around a Soviet military base. Somehow they were approached by the Soviets and their cover was blown. So it was a risky situation, even though Cold War was over, but it was a risky situation. Afghanistan was a very risky situation to get involved in that war, to be present on the battlefield, to cross over the border into this country. And I know that the Americans were also very, staying away from sending too many people and personnel into Afghanistan, because if they end up with the Soviets, captured by the Soviets, it would be
big embarrassment.
But it's risk taking. You see, sometimes taking more risks is worth it. And another thing that I see as a kind of a lesson is that it's very. It can be of huge value to have an operation running for a long time. This cooperation with the Israelis for decades was really something. I mean, you establish contacts, you establish relationships, people get to know each other, you become friends in a way. So just in general for the intelligence work, this is a good thing, I guess. And to be patient, to recruit a source and then patiently waiting for this source to be to make a career and end up at a place where you want it to be is also worth it. So these are the lessons that I see from these operations.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, thank you so much for telling us about those. What's next for your research? Are there any other hidden BND stories that you're pursuing at the moment?
Yes, there is. There are several. One of them involves BND and backed by the German government supporting certain political parties in the Cold War financially, which is quite interesting. So foreign parties, other European countries. So kind of a hidden anti-communist operation that was going on. This is one thing that I'm interested in. There's several others. Also, I did a story on a very famous German journalist. He passed away in 2014. He was a very, very famous war reporter. He was working for TV. He has written 30 books. He has written the most prominent book ever sold in Germany when it comes to political books. And he was a kind of a source for the BND. He was not paid, but he was an information source for the BND. And I got his file as well, and I wrote about it. And this journalist intelligence agency relationship is very interesting. There are some interesting stories as well in this.
Yeah. It's funny you mention that, because years and years ago, I was talking to some journalists who'd been in Afghanistan, and one of their observations were that they had freer rein than a lot of MI6 officers who had to do all sorts of health and safety reports before they could go anywhere. So,
of course. I mean, journalists make perfect sources, especially when it comes to these war zones. Where you need some eyes and ears. And in the case of this one journalist, he traveled to Beirut, to Lebanon, during the time of the civil war. And the BND asked him if he could meet a source of theirs present in Beirut, because they apparently couldn't. They couldn't go. It was too dangerous. But he went there and he interviewed the head of a rebel group in Cambodia. And he did interviews with lots of people that they were interested in. And what you could see in this file was that he showed them the material, the footage that he recorded in the war zones. He showed it before that it was presented on TV, which is something as a journalist you shouldn't do. It's kind of too close of a relationship. But it was a different time back then. It was a Cold War time, and he was not paid. He was not paid any money. He was, I don't know what his motives were. I cannot talk to him anymore because he passed away in 2014. But there's this relationship between intelligence services and journalists.
Yeah, indeed. Well, thank you very much. How are the spy ships doing at the moment? Any more exciting developments on that?
Yeah. Just recently, this Sunday, a vessel was... it was not seized, but special forces of German police raided this vessel in northern Germany after the German military ship reported a drone, and they think that this civilian vessel, it's a vessel that is belongs to an Estonian company but with an all Russian crew, that they were flying this drone from that vessel. And so I think it's still going on. So police is still searching this vessel. Lots of drone activity in Germany, and lots of spy ships. We are looking into right now into submarine technology that was bought in Europe and North America and ended up in Russia. Interesting to see how much of these Western technology is ending up with the Russian military. It's loads and loads of that stuff. I'm also involved in this in ship investigations again.
fantastic. Yeah. Well, where can listeners sort of find more of your reporting and more on these operations that we talked about today?
I think easiest is to follow me on social media. I'm on Blue Sky and still on X as well. And I post most of the stuff that I report about there. And just follow me there for more intelligence-related stories.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much for joining me today, Florian. It's been great to catch up.
Thank you very much.
for listening. This is Secrets and Spies,